The Cappuccino Podcast brought to you in association with Tactical Solutions. For all your tactical solutions, check them out at www.tactical.co.nz.
It's that time again, so grab yourself a cup of joe
and get ready for the Cappuccino with Constable Brian.
All right, so my guest today on the Cappuccino, well, she's actually an old friend, and I shouldn't say that old because she's actually not that old. So she's been a New Zealand police officer. She's been in the Queensland Police. She's now in the Northern Territory Police at the grand esteemed rank of Detective Superintendent. Probably more important than all of those roles in her life is that the fact that she's a mum. She has in a previous life also been a competitive bodybuilder as well. So my great pleasure to introduce Detective Superintendent Kirsten Ingalls from Northern Territory Police to the Cappuccino. How are you, ma'am?
My great pleasure to be on the Cappuccino.
There you go, right.
I've been waiting for this moment, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, you need to get out more. That's what I'm going to say. So the last time you and I spoke, we were together in, well, we're actually at the International Women's Policing Conference, but the last time you and I worked together, we were at the Otahuhu Police Station. Now you're a Detective Superintendent in Northern Territory. Do you want to sort of give us a brief rundown of where you've been since then?
Yeah, so I joined the New Zealand Police in 1998 and started off in South Auckland, remained there till 2004, I think, or five, and then moved to Whangaparoa. Took up a role in Arewa, and then in 2006, January, started with the Queensland Police, and in 2013, started with the Northern Territory Police.
There you go. So it's almost like we've completely reversed, because I'm now at Whangaparoa, you're in the Northern Territory. So, hey, that's great. No worries. All good. So let's wind it all back a little bit. What caused you to go to the Queensland Police in the first place, and what was the culture shock like at first? Because many of our listeners from Canada and America will go, yeah, Australians and Kiwis, you guys are all the same. As you and I both know, we are not. We are a separate identity. So what was it like? What made you make the switch to the Queensland Police?
Well, the funny thing is I don't know who I am anymore because I'm actually an Australian citizen. So at half time, Brian.
Yeah.
I digress. So I've always been an adventurous spirit. So when I was in my very early 20s, I went on my own to live in East Africa for a year. And it's just in my DNA to want to try different things. So when I joined the New Zealand Police, I actually always knew that I would go to Australia. And at the time, there was recruiting in the late 90s to the Queensland Police. I stuck around the New Zealand Police for about 7 odd years. But when I met my husband-to-be, Rob, also a police officer with the New Zealand Police, I told him as I met him, look, this is going nowhere if you're not an adventurous spirit, because I'm up and out of here eventually. So I was always there. When I got to Queensland, we had 2 children 15 months apart, so life was pretty hectic. We got there on about the 3rd of January, and I started at the Queensland Police College on the 5th of January or somewhere around there. The culture shock, well, the college was easy. We were all what I would call accelerated recruitment. So we'd come from all over Australia and New Zealand and also England, and we were in a room together so we could all whinge together about how annoying it was to be a recruit. That was the easy part, Monday to Friday, 8 till 4. The culture shock came when I started in my first station because the recruiters in Australia told me that they wanted me for my innovation, my ideas, my experience. I mean, they really made me feel like I was the one they wanted. When I got to my first shift and I hopped in the car with a recruit who had about, 5 years less than me, not so much. He really didn't care for my thoughts on policing worldwide and my innovative experience and the reputation I already had for work ethic. And that wasn't really on his radar of things to find out about me. He just really wanted me to shut up and do my job and realize that I was now the probationary constable to him. So I think I really struggled. I think I sat in my car and I had in my hand a resignation letter. 3 months into my role in Queensland, I had absolutely had enough. I was starting to feel sick going to work. it really, really didn't suit me at all. And on that day, it's amazing how the world works. On that day, a sergeant at the Eagleby Police Beat, which is a very funny little place in the Northern Gold Coast or Southern Logan, depending on where you come from, rang me and said, will you come to work at the police beat? And there were seven or eight cops there. It was a residential neighbourhood beat. And from there, I sort of found my feet again, going back into that sort of community policing, which has never really been my thing, but I just needed to ground it again. I'd been thrown into the mix with just such a huge police force, different structure, different tactics. I really struggled, to be honest with you.
We could go into a huge debate about community policing, but we won't, because you know that I love it. That's all good. I'll just leave you. Now, you mentioned that you're an Australian citizen. So I guess the big $64 million question for our New Zealand listeners and all of your old cobbers who are listening back here, the All Blacks are playing Australia in the Rugby World Cup final. Who are you backing?
I tend to wait for about three-quarter time. Yep. To see where the score is. My husband, he'll just be mortified to hear me say I tend to back the winners, Brian, so it really just depends on where we're at.
Yeah, good. And spoken like a true detective, so well done. Yeah, just cover all the bases. What's the thing that you miss the most about New Zealand, apart from your old mates, of course, yeah?
Oh my old mates.
Yeah.
Getting back last September and, you know, finding that round the table for dinner one night with my old Ogilvy mates just shows how strong the ties are.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course I miss my family. Of course I miss everyone in my family's there, apart from a couple of them. Yep. So I miss that. In the true spirit of honesty, I don't miss a lot. I feel I love New Zealand. I love the landscape. I love some of the beaches. I hate the weather. I dislike some of the politics of where it's gone. And that's just being really honest with you.
Yeah, cool. So if I asked you, where are you going to retire? Because I know that's still probably about 35 years away, you're all good. So
my 40-year projection.
Where would you be? Will you be on the west coast of the South Island, or will you be up in Burley Head somewhere?
I'd probably, at this stage, would be remaining in the top of Australia. I've fallen in love with the top of Australia.
Yeah, that's all good.
Absolutely. Totally in love with the top of Australia.
Yeah, no dramas. Right. Now, you will be like I was when you went to police college. They used to show us lots of the Queensland police training videos. And we all used to sit there and sort of go, wow, okay, ooh, culture shock there. Was the policing that much different to policing in Otahu or Counties Manukau?
Yes and no. Look, people that do the wrong thing the same way, no matter where you go, I think. But the way that we deal with it, there were different strategies in place in Queensland that I found New Zealand to be. I'm quite a regimented person, which is why I got into the sport I got into.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I remember going to work in Counties Manukau, and I hate the cold with an absolute passion. And there was a rule in place that you had to wear what your senior partner wore. So my goal in life was to be the senior partner in the car so that I could put a jumper and the duty jacket on and kick the fluffy collar. And I was probably, you know, people would line up to not be in the car with me because the guys I worked with all ran hot.
Yeah.
And so I liked that. I liked turning up at a job. I put hats on, full uniform that looked the same. We used to go to certain addresses where you'd go with at least four of you and you would almost march in by the right.
Yeah.
I liked that. I thought it showed a real discipline. Queensland didn't take the same sort of tact. It was a lot looser. I'm not saying it was worse. Yeah. It was different.
Yeah.
So when I got there and it was, you know, we would, instead of having set units, we would go in and there'd be this great big list. And this was the station I was at, the list of jobs that needed filling for the day. And you could sort of fill in whether you wanted to go front counter, prison escort, or let's just say if you got in late, you got left with the dread jobs. And if you got in quickly, you could
pick.
It was just so foreign to me. And that's what I really struggled with. The tactics weren't as rigid as what I was used to. I also noticed that the Queensland police, the Australian police are very aware of the overtime, and the New Zealand, I didn't even know there was overtime when I arrived in Queensland. And when they said, oh, you get overtime for this at, you know, 1.5 or 2, oh my God, are you serious?
Yeah.
There were plenty of opportunities for overtime. So, I think I noticed a big difference in sometimes the motivation. And I think had we got that in New Zealand, we would feel the same way. It's just that we don't have it. So in New Zealand, you keep working and you what, the first eight odd hours of toil were built into your weekly pay. And often, the toil was a lot harder to take. That wasn't the same in Queensland. It was you were handsomely rewarded for the hours that you spent at work.
So what's something that Aussie cops do better than New Zealand cops and vice versa from what you've seen in your career? And it can be anything. It'd be anything from the uniforms here are way better than the uniforms in New Zealand. Who the heck wears light blue shirts? All the way up to here's some of our investigation procedures, and I think we do that better. So knock yourself out. Here's your chance.
So I think I've already alluded to what I loved about the New Zealand police, and that was the discipline, and that was the camaraderie and the goodwill to work. When you knew there was a job to be done, your pure motivation was to get the job done. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't a lot else that you were getting. There were not many kickbacks you were getting for it. In fact, the wage was pretty hard to live on. The New Zealand police was my first free love in policing. I cried when I left. I actually had quite a lot of tears when I made that decision to go. The Queensland police, far, far, far better funded, so a lot more opportunities for courses to get upskilled. Just being, there were a lot more opportunities to do really fun things. In my station, we backfilled for schoolies. That might not have been so fun. Schoolies, the Indy cars. We would get offered to go and police at Dream World at night for the Christmas parade. There were concerts. There were sports parades. There were all sorts of things that you could do that were sort of outside of your core business. And we all know that there's fatigue in just doing the same job in and out. So those really cool things that I got a chance to do, they came quite thick and fast.
Now, because you're an old mate and because I love rattling detectives' cages a little bit, I'm actually going to drop the speed round in right now. Normally it's at the front of the podcast, like you know.
Oh.
I'm gonna drop it in now, right? So for me, Speed is the ultimate cop movie. It's full of adrenaline. It's got Keanu Reeves in it. He's John Wick. He's Bill and Ted, blah, 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 Neo, et cetera, right? So here's my questions for you, right? Yeah, awful. Stop it. If you and I were in the patrol car now, what coffee would you be drinking? What's your coffee order?
Well, funny that you asked that. So what I have is I have a large flat white. I always ask for it half strength. Hold the phone. I want phone. It's a flat white, and I want it extra hot. I want it so hot that it takes me half an hour to drink.
Good work. I was waiting for you to give me an Australianism like a skinny latte, and I was going to say, no, hang on, let's get it sorted. But that's all good. What's the best police movie of all time in your humble opinion?
I'm far more of a TV series type person.
Yeah, I'll give you that question in a second, so you can do both.
Oh, okay,
want.
All right, police movie. Well, I do love Training Day. I shouldn't, but I do.
Yeah, there you go. Yep, nice. Yep. What about your TV series?
Oh, Line of Duty, Hastings.
There you go. Yep,
Jesus,
all good.
Jesus, Joseph, Mary, and the Wee Donkey.
Do you collect anything?
Battle Stars. It's about it.
Yeah, that's it. That's all good. And what's your favourite book of all time? If I said to you, what's the book you've read three or four times? It can't be a training manual, and it can't be a police anything. It can be a police fiction novel, but nothing else.
This is really funny because I don't really reread books. I only read them once, and I've got lovely books that I've loved over the years. I love Shogun. I love City of Joy. Nice big thick ones under the Thornbirds. But the book that I read a few times over is a funny little book written by a New Zealand ex-copper. It's called The Laughing Policeman.
Yeah, there you go.
And it's one of the funniest books I've ever read. Like, the reason I think I read it again is because every time someone comes to my house and I have a few drinks, I pull it out and read one of the stories from it.
I've read it, and you can see yourself in that situation sometimes as well. So yeah, I fully appreciate it. Did you ever think what was the reasoning behind your switch to detective? I mean, when I first joined, I had thought about becoming a detective, but then obviously I got sidelined with a children's TV program and a few other bits and pieces. What was your switch from uniform branch? Was it something that you'd always thought you were going to do? Because like you've said before, you're quite a pragmatic and systematic person. Anybody who knows you, like there's the fun side of you, and then there's also the side that's going on behind, and you are very pragmatic in what you do. So was it always a goal to become a detective?
No, it wasn't. It started in the New Zealand police. So I joined the law enforcement team in Counties Manukau in 2001, and bloody hell, got pregnant. So I remember we used to start every day doing search warrants and climbing up, you know, on top of roofs. And I hid the pregnancy for as long as I could till those pants no longer fit. And I finally admitted that I was pregnant. And I remember that, yeah, I was told, you know, out with you. So I moved next door in Papakura into the child abuse team. Never had thought about it, never was something I wanted to do. Fell in love with the investigations and also went on to do the child forensic interviewing. But I was very, very blatantly told that I was no bang for my buck because if I was sent onto the detective pathway, I'd likely to want to take maternity leave and then probably have another baby.
Right.
So but I remained in. This is, you know, a long time ago.
Yeah.
Things have changed.
Yep.
But that's the truth of the matter. So I remained in the child abuse team in Papakura, then to Otahuhu, then went back to uniform. I love uniform policing. I like being seen as a police officer. I've never made it in the covert squad because I just love being an overt cop too much.
Yep.
And spent all of Queensland in uniform. When I got to the Northern Territory, it was my husband who just kept pushing me. He said, just love investigations. You just have to do it. And I said, I can't be bothered filling out the workbook. So he might or might not have helped me a little bit along the way just to put the words on the paper. So, and when I fell into it, it was like coming home. You know, being able to start something and finish it the whole way through. I love giving evidence in court, get a bit of mongrel in you. You start advocating on behalf of vulnerable victims and witnesses. Investigations is absolutely addictive, and you can be even more methodical in the way that you go about things in that role. So it probably suited me perfectly, to be honest.
Do you think if I'd bumped into you when you were in the LET team after you'd left Otahuhu and said to you, Detective Superintendent Kirsten Ingalls, how's that working for you? Do you think you would have laughed, or do you think you would have gone, oh, I don't know, maybe one day, who knows?
I think I would have laughed uproariously. I think nobody is a recruit three times that wants to climb the ladder, really, honestly. And you do, even though you transfer, accelerated transfer always means going back to the constable rank.
Yeah.
Oh, there may be a few anomalies around that. But by and large, you go back and you're a probationary constable for a certain period of time.
Yeah.
Under some sort of probation. So I don't think I was ever looking at much more. I think I had completed all the qualifications to be a sergeant in New Zealand and had also completed a new paper on for the senior sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I seriously when I went to leave, I spoke with Inspector Janet Hyde, and I made an appointment to tell her I've been in Queensland. And she said, I know why you're here. You're here to ask me if you can promote to sergeant and be on flexible employment because you've got two babies. Remember, that sort of sent me, the tears started coming, no, I'm leaving.
Uh-oh.
Yeah.
So what does an average day look like for a detective superintendent? Because there'll be lots of people out there, listeners who aren't police officers, who are sitting there going, oh, it's just like the Norwegian crime TV series I watch on Netflix, you know, where you go out and you are the OC case and you do things and that type of stuff and everything else. And I think some people, when they actually find out what detectives or detective inspectors do, are a little bit sort of upset. So what does your average day look like for you?
So I've just recently moved back to Darwin from Alice Springs, where I was the detective superintendent of regional crime that looked after all of the crime areas outside of Darwin. So mm-hmm. Now I'm back. My portfolio is sex crimes, child abuse, the joint anti-child exploitation team, the reportable offender management, and the domestic violence. So I guess to put it in perspective, the domestic violence in the Northern Territory homicide rates is 7 times higher than the rest of Australia. We are on a trajectory to nothing good in domestic violence. I'll give you an example. In Alice Springs, over a 7-day period in December 2023, we deployed police to 217 domestic violence incidents, and I repeat, 27,000 people. So we have, it's the biggest problem by far in the Northern Territory. So my day will be getting over what's happened overnight, though I do get those emails. I've already read them by the time I arrive. So it's getting over that, seeing if operationally anything needs to occur. If there are any big jobs, then sit in on briefings or make sure that they've got a media strategy, all the things that you would imagine for big jobs. Them aside, my team are often traveling, so we have a lot of people travelling out to communities. If you know the landscape, the Northern Territory is 1.4 square kilometres, so it's huge, with 60-odd remote communities. They're the bigger ones. These are 100 small ones. So the landscape is very different than anything else you'd see. Then we have a pile of domestic violence projects that have come about through a series of coronial inquests into the murders of Aboriginal women that I sat through last year. So I don't know how far you want me to go into that quite yet.
No, it's all good. Yeah. So, I mean, and again, I think it's one of those things. You're across everything, but it's that, I guess it's that sort of myth of you're only involved in a case, you're going to solve the case by lunchtime. And then once you've solved that case, you're on to the next one. It's one of those things. Completely get it. You've already answered the question, what's one of the biggest challenges facing the Northern Territory Police at the moment? Just so those who haven't been to the Northern Territory have got some idea, how big is the actual Northern Territory? Could you give us a comparison?
It is ginormous. I don't know if I can give you a comparison, but when you look at the population, so New Zealand's far, far, far smaller, and what, got about 5 million?
Yeah.
We're sitting on 250,000 total. So very sparsely populated. So about 120,000 people in Darwin, about 27,000 people in Alice Springs. I think there's about 6 in Tennant Creek, about 10,000 in Catherine, and the rest are dispersed everywhere else. So it's absolutely huge. I mean, you've got Alice Springs, which gets down into the negatives in the winter, and the high 40s in summer. In Darwin, we only have two very, very distinct seasons. So we've got the wet season and the dry season, or the rainy season and the dry season. So we have that. Maybe we've got the tropical monsoon through October through to around now. We have in late sort of October what we call the build-up, where the humidity is sitting at 100% and we can sit it around the mid-30s to 40, and it might feel like mid-40. It's cool. It's wet. It is I absolutely love it, but 99% of the population pretty much hate it. So it's a very, very different landscape than you'll see probably anywhere else in Australia, maybe the top ends of WA and Queensland. That's about it.
Yeah, and I think to put it into some perspective, when I used to do the Variety Bash here, we used to have some teams from the Northern Territory here who couldn't believe that you could drive for a day and actually visit 5 or 6 schools, whereas they would literally drive for 3 days and see one school and then keep on going. So that gives you some idea. It is an absolute huge area. Now, you are coping with many horrific things, sex crimes, and some of the horrors that you see on the job. I know, and we'll talk a little bit about it later on with the investigative interviewing courses you've done and everything else, not to mention your own investigations. How do you cope with it all? Because everybody's got their own coping mechanism.
And I acknowledge now that I'm far less, on the front line of what's going on. We still read it. You're still exposed to it.
Yeah.
The care for my people that are exposed to it daily is always on my mind. How do I do it? It's always been through training. I keep going back to the regimented nature of my personality, and it does me really well. I think I was born with a particular way to compartmentalize work. I still thrive on dealing with people. I still thrive on investigations. A lot of people have asked me over the years, do I train in the morning? I say no. I've normally kept that for the afternoon because it's the circuit breaker. So when I leave work, these days we take home tablets and computers, which is a bit painful, but what that allows me to do is leave at a very reasonable time, go home, train, and break that circuit from whatever's going on. And then if I do have to re-engage, which I do quite often, it's on my terms. I can pick up the things I need to do. I have had some amazing mentors, and one of them used to say to me, it used to really piss me off, and he would say, if you don't write that report tonight, is anyone going to die tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
And no buts. Seriously, is anyone going to die? Yeah, but well, stop thinking you're so damn important. You know, really honestly, sitting there until midnight writing a report, you've got to be kidding me. Now, I'll temper that with sometimes there are, but very, very few. So for me, it's been that training, my nutrition. I'm very, very regimented on that too. Stand what people are going to think. getting a grip on those sort of things. I love to garden. I've grown to love camping, and I love fishing.
Yeah.
So, but they're not things you can do every day. So I think that pie in the sky things that you sort of that align with your days off, with the weather, with your time, with your kids. So, but the consistent things are the things that have got me through. I think also being able to be really open and honest. If I can tell you something honestly, I'm going to. I'm not going to trap it inside. If you've asked me and I think you can handle it, I'm going to tell you what's going on.
You haven't changed since that, hey? God bless. Right, so you've always been interested in physical fitness, though, outside of work, right? And you've even done competitive bodybuilding as well. What is your workout? You've just given us some idea, but what does your workout regime look like now, given your work demands? I'm like you. I use the afternoon as a bit of a circuit breaker. It's my time out for me. I've got no family demands. I've got no work demands. It's like, it's my space. But what are you doing for your workouts? I'm doing like maybe 3 cardio sessions a week and 3 weight sessions a week. You've always been regimented with your training, so how's it looking?
Yeah, about 3, probably 3 weights and 3 cardio, but I generally do a mix of cardio weight type styles. I used to do a lot more heavy stuff, but I found that the heavy stuff was leading to injury, so I backed off that. So I think it's continuously trying to find ways to do progressive weight training. 6 days, I'll do 5 days a week, I'll definitely some sort of weight or cardio. Then I might do one night where I do a 7K walk, and yeah, then I have Fridays off. Fridays are my days off.
Nice.
Yeah, so it's always trying to jam. And I'll tell you an interesting story. When I got to the Northern Territory, I filled in at some very, very remote communities, and they were, you might have heard of the intervention that occurred, and there were container stations built. So literally shipping containers were in a configuration out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. And I went to a few of them for a total period of about 6 or 7 months. And you're on call. There's only 2 of you, and you're in a community. And we did 60 hours of overtime in 1 fortnight when I first got there. I thought I was going to die, quite frankly. But one of my jobs was to look after a prisoner overnight. Now, this is in a very, very small container in the middle of nowhere, and he's in a container watch house. So my one job was to watch him. So I dragged in all my weight, stuff that I'd taken on the plane and in the car and taken out there, and I did a full workout while he snoozed, and I had full eyes on him. I was completely filling my job, but also doing chest press and a few burpees and all that straight outside the cell. Hilarious. But so I'll often find a way to do it. To be honest with you, come hell or high water, I'll do it.
Yeah.
If I'm called into a job that's as an investigator, if I was called into a job and the emergency was over and I was halfway through a workout, I'd say, can you give me 1 hour? I don't tell them why. Like, you know, we just need somebody for the afternoon. I finish my workout, have a shower, and then I'm in there. I'll give you the best 10 hours I've needed.
You are, you're like me, I guess. You're a firm believer of the link between physical and mental health for police officers. I have no doubt that you are probably doing, I'm not going to say they're rousing speeches, but presentations for some of your graduates and that type of stuff. What would you say to a recruit who goes, oh, yeah, now that I've passed college, I've got everything sorted? And we've all seen it. We've seen that person that's graduated through college like a machine. They look like Chris Hemsworth. And then the next time you see them, they look like more like Homer Simpson. And you're like, my God, what's happened? It's like, oh, I'm not training. I'm not doing anything else. What advice would you give them? Like, you're super regimented. I don't think I am super regimented, but when I look at it, I'm like, I train 5 or 6 days a week like you. The 6 days are optional. Maybe it's a walk. I'm pretty strict on my diet and everything else. It's like, I don't think I'm that restrictive, but what advice would you give somebody who is new to the police and sort of says, oh, is it really that important?
Firstly, I would say that regimented is probably a word I keep repeating. It's probably not a good word. That's your normal. So when it's your normal, you don't notice it as being that abnormal from anyone else. I recently spent 6 weeks staying with mates, and the guy said to me, I just, you know, like your lifestyle is, I just can't believe it. So I didn't think it was particularly out of the norm. And then moving on to the other question about the recruits, I would say I'm very concerned for you. If you feel that you can let go of everything that you've got whilst you're moving into shift work,
yeah,
your stress levels, depending on the job you did before this, your stress levels are undeniably going to go up, and that'll be not just what you see, but the time frames, the hierarchical nature of policing, all of that's going to come hitting you like a bit of a freight train. And it really, I'm very concerned for you. If you actually think that you're going to be a better person without a good, I want to say regime again, but I'm too scared.
No, no, you're right. You're right. And look, I have to be honest, I actually have a saying that's up in my study at home, and it says, if you're in law enforcement, you have no right to be unfit. And that's pretty much it, as far as I'm concerned. So we've answered it.
It's I've got a daughter who's a police officer now, and I was on her all the time. You know, you will find a way to prioritize what's a priority to you. She's an amazing girl. When she was younger, if she needed to get from home to the shopping center and I wasn't there, she would organize. She would go on overtime, and she would have the series of events that could occur to get her from home to the shopping center and back. It was like a fine-tuned machine. And I say, if that's your priority, you'll make it happen.
Yeah, it sounds exactly like a mother, just quietly, but that's all good. Right, so yeah, clearly you left the Queensland Police. It was quite interesting there because you actually did the detective superintendent's voice and the mother's voice at the same time. It was quite scary. Right, so then you left the Queensland Police, clearly, because you're now at the Northern Territory Police. What was your cause for change there? And like people will look and say, oh, it's Australia, you know. It's like when people look at Australia and New Zealand and go, oh, it's Australia and New Zealand, you guys are the same. And I've lived in Queensland, I've lived in Victoria as well, so I know that there is quite a difference between a Vic and a Queenslander. So what was the cause for change, and what was the big difference between the states or the territories when you got there?
So it's first important to know that I started my Queensland Police career in the southeast. I lived in the Upper Gold Coast, worked in the Logan District. You know, I sort of had sort of that adventurous spirit thing going on.
Yeah.
I went out for coffee with my husband. By this stage, we had three children, and I said to him, "Not done yet. I think there's another adventure on the horizon."
Yeah.
And I saw the whites of his eyes, and he sort of went a bit green. And he said, "What did you have in mind, dear?" I said, listen, I've seen some jobs in Cape York. Cape where? So if you scoot to the very, very top of Australia, the very, very tip on the right-hand side, and then you shuttle down about 150 kilometres on the west coast, Cape, you'll come to a place called Weeper. So we applied for a job and took it in Weeper. And your closest station is about a 12-hour drive away in Cairns, through a very corrugated and often cut-off road. So you don't get much more remote than that. So we did 2 years up there. While we were up there, we bought a boat and we could drop two of the kids at school, grab the other one and be in the waterways in about 8 minutes. It was phenomenal. Croc infested, absolutely croc and shark infested, but we learned the art of fishing and fell in love with fishing. We fell in love with the red dirt, the tropical monsoon weather, the people, the indigenous culture there. And we loved everything about it. So we got to the end of our 2 years and we needed probably a better schooling structure. It wasn't quite meeting all of our needs. So we looked at Thursday Island, and the housing there wasn't so great. And I was flicking through an association magazine and saw the Northern Territory pop up. And I tell a lie, saw the pay there and said to my husband, you need to apply. I'm going to take a couple of years off. You need to apply. So we went through the application. With three children, it really wasn't feasible for both of us to join straight away. I remember he did a vehicle stop on me in Weeper, did lights and sirens while taking the kids to school. And I'm like, what are you doing? This is a very tiny little community that we're in. He says, I've got it. He's just jumping for joy. I've got it. I got it in the Northern Territory Police. I said, great. Awesome. Where are you stationed? He goes, Catherine. I said, Catherine? Never even heard of it. Where is it? So we both on our phones Googling where the hell Catherine is. And anyhow, we moved over there. Catherine is about 300 kilometres south, 350 actually. That's 130 speed limit. So you get there in about, you know, less than 3 hours.
Yeah.
And we ended up in Catherine. So what was the biggest, I can't remember your second question.
So what was the biggest difference between the states and the territories? I'm laughing because I used to work with your husband in Counties Manukau as well, and I can see you saying to him, let's go to Northern Territory. I can see his eyebrows raising as you suggest that. So I could see his facial expression. It was hilarious. So, yeah, so what was the big difference between the states and territory? I'm guessing, and I mean, I when you said, I did 4 years in Katherine, 6 years in Darwin, I know where Darwin is, but I had to look at Katherine and I was like, jeepers, that's pretty remote. So I'm guessing the isolation was a big factor for the two of you, but was that the biggest sort of shock between the states and the territories or not?
No, it's not. The Northern Territory, when you say Australia is an extension of New Zealand, maybe a lot of other places are, but the Northern Territory is not.
Yeah.
And so when you work in the Northern Territory, it's remote as the heart of the territory. Yeah. Darwin's not the heart of it, remote is. So yeah. When I went to Katherine, they were immediately calling for people to go out remote. And that's a reoccurring theme, is that we need people to go out and serve in remote locations. And we've got options from people being posted there and moving their families to people doing stints there. So within about a month of me being operational in Katherine, I went out to remote and I didn't come back for about 7 months. So I spent about a year away from my family that year. But you've got the stations are remote to the point where you might have to catch a plane to one station, then wait for the tide to be high and then jump in the police boat to get over to them.
Yeah.
So they are so remote. Some are tiny, some are huge. Some have huge, huge issues. We have a particular community in the Northern Territory that is coming to the attention of the news regularly at the moment, and there's spear fights. We've had homicides with spears. So there's four New Zealanders that have come there. I think they'll be, I don't know if shocked is the right word, but it's an amazing abundance of rich culture.
Yeah.
Not all of what's going on is great. Not even going to pretend it is.
Yeah.
But the environment is magical.
So if I said to you, what's your best story from your Australian policing career so far? And I'm not going to let you include your university course because we'll talk about that and some of the training that you've done because that's groundbreaking. What would you think it would be?
Oh, now that I'm the back of the bag, my best investigation, but I don't know if that's as interesting as...
One that is a true sort of typical Australia story. So like when I talk to my friends in Canada, I'll talk to them about attending domestic violence incidents on boats up here up in the Gulf Harbour, which I know that you'll know about, or surf rescues at Orewa, that type of stuff. And they go, wow, that's amazing because they're landlocked, obviously. But if you have anything like that, you've like you said, you've had a couple of spear attacks, which is a bit random. And it's okay if there isn't.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking about the true nature of at times getting called. I mean, I sat in a container station. I was posted there with another female who actually had come from the New Zealand police as well. It was another 250 kilometres southeast from Katherine, so very remote, out of the Roper Gulf. It was a landlocked station and it was in the middle of a working cattle station. So you had to go off the main road, down through very, very corrugated for quite a distance, and then through cattle gates. And then you got to all these containers and houses, and that was where I stayed for a good, I think, close to 6 months there.
Yeah.
There's a billabong, probably all over grass and corrugation in the middle of that. So, there was a billabong. And they had a few fish and a few freshwater crocodiles. I woke up one morning and the next door neighbour called me over. Kirsten, Richard Kirsten, the policeman Kirsten. And I saw they had a saltwater crocodile in their front yard with its mouth taped up and they were, standing around this crocodile. And I thought, am I actually awake? Am I really in the middle of absolutely nowhere without a coastline in sight for hours? And there's a saltwater crocodile in the front yard, very alive with its mouth taped up.
Yeah,
and I said, you want to jump on it? I said, I absolutely do not want to jump on it. Thank you very much. But,
yeah. Hey, look, thanks for the invite. I get it. Now, you used to chat with ABC Radio on some of the crime stats figures and correlation between alcohol and crime. And it's something that you will hear police from around the world talk about. I once heard a police inspector say if we could get rid of alcohol, we'd probably get rid of about 90% of all crime across the board. And it was only a sort of sweeping generalization, right? But there is a direct correlation between booze and crime. And trying to get all the departments and the organizations working together to curb alcohol harm. Why is it so difficult, do you think, given all the research, given all the findings from around the world and the harm it causes, Why do you think it's so difficult? Do you think it's because of the fact that maybe the alcohol groups have lobbyists, there's things going on that we don't know going on behind in the shadows, or is it just the fact that we all as a culture just enjoy our booze so much? What do you put it down to?
Probably a mix of all of the above.
Yeah.
And for the record, I have to say that I don't think alcohol causes some of the harm. I think it's most definitely a huge contributor to it, but I don't think, for example, a domestic violence remove the alcohol, the domestic violence stops. I don't believe that because it's a power and control thing. But what we notice is that the voracity and the, you know, the fierceness of the attack is far greater when alcohol's involved. I tend to think that police have so long been seen as the answer for everything. Not many people are wandering around at 1 a.m. in the morning from other agencies seeing the absolute harm.
Yeah.
And in the cold light of day the next morning when we're speaking in an office, it doesn't sound nearly as bad as what it was for my people or women's shelters or doctors and nurses or ambulance. What we're seeing, they all get in a car and really go out there and have a look. I'd love to get, you know, this is just Kirsten talking. I would love to get some of the people that promote alcohol to come and jump in the car if it were possible and really see, you know, the what alcohol enables to occur. And I think perhaps we'd get some, maybe a bit of a change of heart. You think back to the big things that have made me change my heart about things I was staunch about, and then normally being, it has to be a real smack over the head with something very raw and real. I think that they would get that if they came out. But yeah, I think that too long we've taken up the slack. We've become the counsellor. We've become the person. When a intoxicated person is lying on the street at night on a footpath, really and honestly, is that a police matter? You know, but we're asked to pick them up because they might cause issue. They might be at harm for themselves. As far as I'm concerned, that's a social issue, if not a health issue. But we're there, so we'll get called, and we know we have to do the right thing, and we always step in and do the right thing. And I think it's time to push back a little bit and expose some of the social issues for what they are, and let's start looking at, you know, an innovative way for other agencies and other stakeholders to become involved at that right at the time that the incident's occurring, rather than considering it in a cold light of day in an office the following day.
Give me a best sales pitch. What makes the Northern Territory so attractive, and why would you recommend a career change for New Zealand Cots? I mean, you've done three different police departments, or people who have thought about policing as a career, because I think sometimes people who look at police and go, oh, no, I was rejected by maybe the Queensland police, they don't actually realise, you know what, I could try give the New Zealand give the New Zealand police a shot. I could give the Northern Territory police a go. So give me your best sales pitch. Why should people come to Northern Territory Police?
Well, my theory is if you're thinking about it, why don't you just do it? What have you got to lose? It is a remarkable place. Does it have its issues? You bet it does. But it's a land of opportunity. There's only around 1,650 police officers in the Northern Territory. So it's a land of opportunity where you can bring your experience. You have to do a little bit of time to just get your feet under the desk and make sure you know the systems and the ways it goes there. But following that, I feel like I've been offered the opportunity to try and experience so many different things that I just wouldn't get in one. I think we do become stale. Police hate change, and they also hate doing the same thing every day. So we become a bit of an oxymoron of ourselves. And I like to think that reinventing yourself, trying something new, is really important to keep yourself contemporary, to keep your enthusiasm going. The contrast in the Northern Territory is probably greater than you'll get in most other places. And the weather is spectacular. Whether you love the cold, dry of the desert, or whether you love the heat and humidity of the monsoon on top end.
There you go. And there's not much rain either, is there, if we're honest?
Oh, no. I think it actually gets huge amounts of rain, but they all just happen in a very, very short period of time.
Right. Now, if Detective Superintendent could give Recruit Engels three pieces of advice for her policing career at the Royal New Zealand Police College in Porirua, what would they be and why?
I don't know if she'd listen. It's not going to chill the hell out. You're sort of getting an idea of my personality now, and I think I always wanted everything really quickly. I thought I would miss out if I didn't jump in really quickly. I wanted to cram as much as I could into the least amount of time. But what that meant is I missed a few of the better opportunities to the side. Like, for example, when I look back, I would love to have been a recruit instructor at one of the colleges. Really love to do that. I love to teach.
Yeah.
I was too much on a trajectory to get to where I needed to go to stop and smell the roses at a few of the places. In New Zealand, I really wanted to do search and rescue. You know, I just didn't stop long enough. I kept trying to find a way to not go up the rank, because like I said, I was a recruit three times, but to find to march quickly to the next direction. And I think there would be great benefit in just stopping for a minute and just finding contentment with where I was, rather than constantly trying to find the next hill to conquer.
Yeah, and I think sometimes people forget with the police, and this is the same in any career as well, sometimes when a door shuts, actually another one's opening somewhere. You just haven't realised that it's actually opened, and there's your in. So, yeah, great stuff. When you started at Northern Territory, you recognised a shortfall in the forensic interviewing and worked on a course with Northern Territory Police and Deakin University. Can you give us a brief outline of the course and why and what was the need?
So when I had done child forensic interviewing in New Zealand and worked in the Harvick House there in the multi-agency approach, I'd had a look at the way they did it in Queensland and dabbled in it. When I got to the Northern Territory, they elected to go to an online university module based course. So there was no face-to-face at all. I fundamentally don't believe that way of teaching is the best for hard skills.
No.
Like, this is actually an interviewer where you need to be able to sit in a room with a child and interview them. How on earth can you learn that through a contact course? So I quickly moved into the child abuse area and asked, we started getting complaints about the way child forensic interviews were being done, and it got as high as the judiciary. They had identified the interviews coming through the courts weren't as good as they could have been. So timing is everything. I jumped on that opportunity and petitioned to the executive to send me to Victoria to do their child forensic interviewing course with the view of I'll learn how to run a course there and come back and implement it. So I reached out to my Victorian colleagues and spent 1 month of their course there, built relationships, which are the cornerstone for any sort of thing that is new, came back to the Northern Territory. Very quickly, people said, you won't be able to do it. You'll never get a course in 6 months' time that we don't have. In 6 months' time, less than actually 4 months' time, I invited up a Victorian detective sergeant, and him and I co-facilitated the very first course to the Northern Territory Police investigators. We also invited in our Department of Youth and Child, CIVS, our Territory Families, and they came and did the course as well. From there, I refined and remodeled it, and it was quite hard work doing it alongside another police force. So I reached out to Deakin University and partnered with them. And since from then till current day, we now deliver a two-week course. And of course, the first week is delivered by a Deakin lecturer and Northern Territory Police. And it's predominantly the theory supplemented with the context of how we actually put it into place. One without the other is worthless to me. So the key to this course is having the why, but then not just having an external academic teach something, but then me hopping or someone else hopping straight up and saying, now I'm going to, you know, show you how what she said can now be put into context. So the second week is very much a hands-on week where we go out the week before the course and we deliver a memory event to a whole lot of five-year-olds. It consists of police walking into basically an assembly and saying, hi, I'm Superintendent Kirsten. How are you? And then, yes, and I say something like, you know, last year I went to the Darwin show and I lost my son. And then I'll go through a series of events about finding my son, delivering it as if it actually happened. And there's key ways to engage them with their sight, their sound, their smell, their feeling. And then you basically leave that assembly none the wiser that the story wasn't actually true or why you even came. But they're five-year-olds. They don't question why.
No.
You have to sort of abruptly end it and say, okay, so I found my son, and now I'm going to go back to the police station. They all come up and give you a cuddle and you leave.
Yep.
There's not another word said about it. The teachers are all in on it. And in the second week of the course, we invite those same children back for a come-and-play day at the police college, which is where the course is held. So they come in and we fill their day with seeing the horses, seeing the dogs, buying the cars, getting lectures about road safety and all that sort of stuff. And one by one, we plucked them off for the course participants who were told, all I'll tell you is that I went and spoke to these kids one day. That's it. So they then have to interview them using the skills they've got to an evidential level. And so, you know, they start interviewing the children and see if they're able to extract what my story was. And it's the most fun thing. You know, some of the kids will swear black and blue that they weren't there the day Sergeant Preston came, and they were.
Yeah.
Other kids will, you know, you'll ask them a question, and I just want to track back to police carry guns and have they ever killed anyone. It's hilarious. So I'm a monitor, so I sit outside on the set. So for me, it's absolute gold, and I laugh till the tears run down my cheeks. For the guys in the interview, it's torturous. It's just a great day. On another day, we take them out to a school with children with cognitive impairments, and we show them how 1 hour with these children, the barriers you will break down. So we're trying to prevent the police arriving at a child who's got cognitive impairments, whipping them away to a soft interview room, saying, I don't want any of their support people around, and it's not your business, it's a police matter, and then wondering why they don't disclose.
Yeah.
So we're trying to teach them another way to actually embrace the support services, embrace those people that can help you learn their communication styles. You know, if that takes 2 weeks, you're better off spending 2 weeks doing that before you interview them. And then the last thing we do is we go and work with the Helping People Achieve, which is cognitively impaired adults who work in employment. And we do the same memory event with them. And then we let our interviewers loose. And that is absolutely hilarious. All of the people at the place that I do the memory event, they're all in on the secret too. They think it's hilarious too.
Yeah.
They can play a bit of hijinks sometimes on the interviewers, which is much to my delight.
Look, and let's be honest, and I say this as a community officer and as also a veteran police officer like yourself, if you can't speak or relate to a seven-year-old, you're probably not going to make a great police officer, if we're all fair and fairness.
Yeah, and you know what? They're going to be the one probably in a room full of oppositional people, they'll probably be the most honest person in the room and the one you'll get the most out of.
So you're also attending conferences worldwide, talking about what you're trying to achieve in Northern Territory. What's the crux of your current drive and what you're trying to achieve in Northern Territory?
So my eyes are very much on the domestic violence area at the moment. So we've just announced a domestic violence and youth command. We didn't have one before, so I'm really proud of the fact that we're being very, very overt with the community and with our own internal stakeholders that domestic violence is our priority. We're piloting a co-responding program in Alice Springs in the near future, and that will see police attend the incident, then come back, and we're introducing a police frontline risk screening tool, which most other jurisdictions already have, but we didn't, and there's some reasons why we haven't got that tool now. There's a lot of cultural aspects to something that maybe other jurisdictions don't have. We've finally got one, and that frontline risk screening tool will inform the co-responder unit as to which relationships they need to get involved in. What we're trying to do is move the counselling or the DV prevention space off police because we're not DV specialists. So that's another thing we've got. We've just formed a dedicated DV training cell in the Northern Territory. And just this week, I've just left there to come and do this podcast. We've got a brand new one full week of external stakeholder DV foundational training, and it is brilliant. And that'll be supplemented with a second full week of just police operational matters. But that third week is delivered by DV specialists. It involves victim survivors' stories. It involves times where the response has been wonderful and other times where it hasn't been as good as it could be, talking about voice of control, what that is. So we've increased our DV training exponentially, and we've just put a tiered approach into training throughout the whole agency. So we're not just training recruits, but now having markers for everyone. And we've updated our general order. There's a range of things that we've got going on in the domestic violence space. But one of my key roles is advocating fiercely for across the sector. This is not a police problem. Do you know, I'm going to tell you something here, Brian. It might not be popular, but I think the police could do the best job possible in domestic violence, and I don't think we'd see the stats go down.
That's a tragedy, if we're all honest and fair about it. So All right, so let's change the subject a little bit, because I can clearly see you're resting on your laurels, doing nothing in the Northern Territory. You're working your rear end off, Gil. Good work. So I'm going to ask you for three of the things that are on your bucket list. What are they? This is the final question for you, Kirsten.
Oh, my goodness. Bucket list. So I really want to go to parts of America.
Yep.
I want to go to Hawaii, New Orleans. I'd like to go to Cuba. Those things are right there. I want to learn another language. So I'm just in the middle of deciding which one that will be. But I get too caught up in my head and think, what could I do with it, rather than just really,
have some fun with it. Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Have some fun with it.
Yeah.
And I would like to go and work overseas at some point.
There you go. Can't argue with that. So, incredible as this may sound to the listener, but when Kirsten used to work in Otahu, she was actually the shy one in the iCar with her partner. But if we're honest, and we both know who your partner was, you weren't going to get a word in edgeways. So that was fine anyway.
Which partner are you talking about?
Love to Constable Bradley. Yep, so that's
all. Oh, yeah. Conan, yeah, that's because he took all the airtime.
Yeah,
that's
exactly,
fine.
Yeah. So keep up the stellar work you are doing, my friend. If we are interested in having a look at Northern Territory Police, no matter where we are in the world, just go to Google and type in Northern Territory Police Recruiting. Is that the best way to do it?
Yeah, absolutely. Facebook, our website probably. But look, I have always extended the opportunity. I did a story in the New Zealand Herald not long after we got there, and one of the association. I'm more than happy for people to ask me. I've spoken to a lot of Kiwis over the last few years, and I think, I don't think my door's going to be beaten down, so maybe I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, like, it's all good, yeah.
So I'm more than happy, because I think it's important that you canvass where you go, because it is a very difficult process.
Yeah, no worries. All right, so keep up the good work that you are doing, my friend. It's inspirational. It does make us very, very proud here for all the old county's Manukau staff to go, Kirsten Engels is the detective superintendent. And if we're truthful about it, when I bumped into Kirsten at the International Policing Women's Conference, I asked her what she was presenting, and she told me, I think somebody walked past and went, morning, ma'am. And I'm like, are they talking to you, Kirsten? And she went, yes, that's me. Yeah. So, full respect to you. We will catch up soon. Thank you for taking part in the Cappuccino. It's been an absolute blast. Like Kirsten said, get hold of the Northern Territory Police if you are interested in maybe having a look at it or something else, or you can get hold of Kirsten directly. All you've got to do is look on the Northern Territory Police website and you will find her. I'm sure that if she does take you as your recruit, her finder's fee will be nothing more than a coffee, and you will know what type of coffee she takes now. So there you go. Detective Superintendent, thank you very much for your attendance at the Cappuccino. I look forward to talking to you again soon. Take care, my friend.
Thank you. What a pleasure.
Thanks for listening. But please do Constable Brian and I a favour and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss out on the next Cappuccino podcast. Real people, real stories.